Murphy to officially start today's session. Kate?
Thanks, Jean, and welcome, everybody. Before we get started with our technical presentation, I just wanted to provide a brief overview of the Design and Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Sites program that's sponsoring this webinar series. Design and Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Sites, are commonly referred to as DCHWS, is a collaboration between the Environmental Protection Agency and the Society of American Military Engineers, or SAME. Our objectives through a series of webinars and symposium events is to facilitate open and frank information exchange among professionals from both private and public sectors regarding design and construction issues at hazardous waste sites, including effective methods, lessons learned, project management approaches, and applications of technologies. It also provides a forum for presentations describing current practices and approaches, management techniques, and field experiences in the area of design and construction. And last and most importantly, it enhances the communication networks and promotes continued discussion on a lot of these challenges and issues we have in the design and construction arena. There are a number of events, as I alluded to, that DCHWS sponsors and puts on. There's the webinar series, of which this is one of the webinar events. We also have two symposium events, one in the East in Philadelphia. The third delivery is scheduled for April 2020. Registration for that event is open, and the agenda should be sent out in the next day or two. So if you're interested in attending an in-person event, I would suggest that you look into that event. We also have a sister symposium in the West held in Denver, Colorado. That fifth delivery is scheduled for the last week in October of 2020. The registration and call for abstracts is not yet open, but please stay tuned to future webinars for more information on those. With the seminar series, there are 8 to 10 webinars planned for fiscal year 2020. The first webinars, of which this is one of them, is focused on presentations that were actually delivered at past DCHWS symposiums. Ryan actually delivered a similar presentation that he's doing today at the DCHWS East event last year in Philadelphia. There are some additional webinars that will be selected and advertised to folks on design and construction topics through the rest of the year. In addition to these webinars, we are also working on a spring 2020 EPA SAMI in-person construction management two-day training. I'll give you more information on that in future webinars and different information venues to get that word out when it is scheduled. So before I introduce our speakers, this slide just talks about the two webinars that are scheduled, one in February and one in March under the DCHWS webinar series. As you can see, both the times and the registration link is open. So if either the topic of in-situ thermal treatment and enhanced bioremediation remedies in design, construction, and optimization, or reducing cost risk in remedial action budgets using supplemental analysis interests you, I encourage you to sign up for those. The registration links are on the slide. So with that, I'd like to introduce our two presenters. Both presenters are from AECOM. Our first presenter is Junaid Sadek. He is a subject matter expert in sequence stratigraphy and sedimentology. He is a senior geologist at AECOM with over a decade of experience teaching professional courses in applied sequence stratigraphy both locally and internationally. He has a master's in petroleum geology from the University of Bergen, Norway, and a PhD from the University of Texas. Accompanying Junaid is Ryan Samuels, also from AECOM. He is a lead stratigrapher at AECOM, focusing on extrapolating sedimentological and stratigraphic information from cores and well logs for sequence stratigraphic analysis. He has a master's degree in sequence stratigraphy from Texas A&M University and a bachelor's in geology from Franklin and Marshall College. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Junaid and Ryan to begin the technical presentation.
Great. Thanks, Kate. We both really appreciate the opportunity to be able to present on this platform today. Today's presentation, as mentioned by Jean, will be an overview of the fundamentals of sequence stratigraphy and how it can be successfully applied for developing robust conceptual site models and developing remedial strategies. So in this presentation, Today's two-hour presentation is going to be divided into three different lectures. The first is going to cover an introduction and the background comparing sequence stratigraphy to today's correlation method of lithostratigraphy. We'll then dive into a discussion of the fundamentals of sequence stratigraphy, and finally wrap up with its application and how and demonstrate several case studies. Now, because we're expecting and anticipating questions throughout, we've also decided to incorporate two question and answer sessions. There'll be a 5-minute Q&A separating lecture two from lecture three, and then there'll be a longer Q&A session at the end of the presentation where we'll be able to answer some additional questions that we weren't able to get time to. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Janaya to get into the presentation.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our session on sequence stratigraphy. And today, it's good to know, like, there's a good number of geologists here participating as audience. Also, it's good that we have engineers and regulators and academic people around to listen to it, because we believe in integration. But today's focus is on sequence stratigraphy, and basically, sequence stratigraphy is the science or art of doing subsurface stratigraphy, which evolved out of the petroleum industry. And the basic strength of this method is its predictability. That's why, like, when oil companies want to drill a well deep in the ocean, spending millions of dollars, they want to be able to predict where the sand bodies are, where the flow paths are, is there a trap and all that. And the same thing applies to our environmental industry. And in fact, even more so, because we have quite often such lack of data and so much uncertainty that we need to be model-based and we need to be predicting before coming up with a remedial strategy. So sequence stratigraphy, to simplify it, it's a three-step process. So thanks, Ryan. So we start with observation, and that is basically looking at our data. So we hardly have seismic data in the environmental industry, although of recent we are seeing some of those well log data. It could be gamma, resistivity, it could be borehole lithology data, CPT, HPT. And also looking at outcrop is very important for analogs. So you make your observations from that. You want to interpret your subsurface. So you do facies analysis, try to understand how big the sand bodies are. Basically, you're trying to understand your confining units and flow units and their geometry and the deposition environment. Once you're able to do that, then you're able to predict the trends of the aquifer, and then the trends of your confining layers. And for that, we do sequence stratigraphy. So, course objectives. So, as you know, like, we are here for 2 hours only, including question and answers, so we'll make you experts of sequence stratigraphy right here in 2 hours. Not really, yeah, you know the reality. So what I've been learning myself sequence stratigraphy since the early 90s, and I'm still a student. So we don't expect you to become experts in 2 hours, but what we expect is at the end of the course, you'll go back with the feeling that geology is important, and there's a distinction between lithostratigraphic approach versus sequence stratigraphy, and you will also learn how to distinguish your faces using your lithologic data, geophysical data, and how to establish depositional models. And finally, to go back with an appreciation for sequence stratigraphy and its application in the environmental industry. So, I know, like, we have a good number of geologists here, but we also have a lot of non-geologists. Therefore, we start with asking the question, what is stratigraphy? To put it simply, stratigraphy comes from the original word strata or layers. So in in this case, layers of rocks or sediments. And more practically, for our environmental purpose, stratigraphy is the method of reducing the uncertainty between the boreholes. So you have got your borehole data, you see a clay layer, and you are interested to know, is that confining layer continuous? What's happening in between two boreholes? And stratigraphy is the method of resolving that uncertainty. So, since there is quite a number of geologists here, I can safely ask this question. How many types of stratigraphy can you name? So feel free to put an answer, and we'll give you a few minutes or a few seconds.
And I'll remind everybody, there's a window in the lower left corner where you can type in your response. You can either indicate the number if you don't have enough time to type them all in, or give us some examples.
Yeah, so, well, I see a good number of names there. Chronal stratigraphy, doing stratigraphy with time. I see lithostratigraphy. I see hydrostratigraphy. Okay, good. So now let's look at how many types of stratigraphy we have out there. So, yeah, many people mentioned lithostratigraphy. Okay, so many people mentioned lithostratigraphy, so that's looking at the rocks or sediments and understanding the stratigraphy. So there are other ways of stratigraphy. For example, if you are a biostratigrapher, you're interested in looking at fossils and going by timeline. Like some people mentioned chronostratigraphy. Many of these stratigraphy methods you're seeing here are actually chronostratigraphy, that is, going by timeline and saying like, okay, during this time, this was deposited. And you could do it by looking at fossils. You could be looking at depositional environments and other methods. But what we are going to learn today is sequence stratigraphy. And even within sequence stratigraphy, there are many different methods of doing it. And most popular, the genetic and the depositional stratigraphy. And in this course, we'll be working with the depositional sequence stratigraphy. Okay. And before even we go into sequence stratigraphy, let's start with looking at the different challenges we have in determining subsurface heterogeneity. So here's a hypothetical scenario. Imagine you have got three monitoring wells, okay, and maybe in this monitoring well number two, you encounter some contamination and you wonder like, is it continuing on this one? Why don't I see that contamination here? And such questions come to your mind. But before addressing the contamination issue, you're first interested to correlate like what's happening between the boreholes. So you can see in each of these wells, there's a layer of sand, sandwiched between two layers of clay, right? So I know what's going in your mind. I know what you attempted to do. You attempted to join up all the sand as a single layer, right? Because that appears reasonable. And then you wonder, like, if it's the same sand, what's happening? What's the reason that you have your contamination here and you don't have the contamination there? Should we put a new well here and do a new monitoring? Also, suppose you have a drinking water well far down below, and is that any concern for this well? Isn't it very deep? Isn't it deep enough to be unrelated to these sedimentations? These are the questions in your mind. But remember, at this point, you have no understanding of the geology. So let's try to bring in some geology in the picture. So, in the background, what we have done is brought in an outcrop. Instead of a subsurface data, here is an outcrop image of a fluvial point bar, and what we're doing is like putting it as a proxy for subsurface geology. Now, immediately you see like here in this picture, all the white areas is sand, and the dark areas are clay. This is from the Drumheller Formation in Canada. And then Now you can also see, if you put in all the clear lines clearly with these red markers, how all the sand bodies are actually different sand bodies. So this is actually all lateral accretion going in that way in a fluvial setting. And this sand body 1 is not the same sand body as 2 and not the same sand body as 3. And you can see like that sand body actually pinches out between these two clay layers, and there are these barriers so that the contamination is not actually moving in any of these directions. On the other hand, imagine a scenario like if you had a contamination in this sand body in well 3, then it would probably have a connectivity to your drinking water well. You see, so as soon as we understand the background geology, our concept changes, we correlate in a different way, and our remedial strategy will be very different. Now, our greatest challenge here is no one is giving you that picture behind, right? So you have to understand the subsurface using facies analysis and sequence stratigraphy, come up with a model, and then look back at your wells on the basis of that. So now what I will do is like we'll walk through a little bit of the history of stratigraphy, how we came into sequence stratigraphy, and what was the world like before that. So from the 19th century till the 50s, very recently, we were very prone to doing stratigraphy just by looking at outcrops, especially in North America with such wonderful outcrops in Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming. People were going out and naming rocks based on their properties and calling them formation. But the problem is that because of geographical locations, some person working in one area was not aware, like another geologist is working in a different area, looking at the same rocks, but naming it differently. And therefore, you come up with a weird situation like what you can see here, those orange dots you see, what are those? Those are artificial markers to say like this shale and that shale is different because actually there's only a geographical boundary between those two formation names. Also, there are other certain rules in defining formations. For example, you never allow to have the same facies name or same formation name when there is an intervening rock which is different. For example, this limestone and that limestone could look exactly the same, but just because you have a clay layer in between, you would have to have different names for that. Now, if you guys find this picture pretty familiar to your sites even today, you are actually looking at some mindset of the 50s going by formation name. And quite often, like when we are working in different projects, we come into issues of, okay, no, this is a different formation. How can you call this the same formation? But this is how it evolved. Next slide. So basically, are we just putting flags when we're just going by formation name? Right. And then here comes the 70s, the revolutionary time, when people started thinking about sediments in a very different way. The concept of facies came in. And by facies, we mean the sum total of physical and biogenic characteristics of rocks. And what it did, you can see right now with the facies concept, what you could do is you could have the same facies recurring at different levels. So there is no rule relegating that the same facies cannot appear twice. So which is a major improvement. But the problem still is, there was no understanding of deposition environment related to these facies, and there was no facies transition. You'd never know like why this facies is right there in the middle of other facies and what's the relationship between this one and that one. So that's a 70s show, and nothing bad about the 70s show. It's a funny show, but at the end of the day, it's a funny show only. And if you're still doing stratigraphy like this, remember, like, you were stuck in the 70s. But not everything was bad in the good old days. So, in fact, if you think of Burrell, Joseph Burrell back in 1917 came up with this neat concept of base level. So what he said is like, there is a base level which could be a level of a river or a lake, and any area above, any deposits above that base level is subjected to erosion, and any area below the base level is subjected to accumulation or deposition. And imagine, like, over time, if that base level changes because sea level changes or other factors, tectonic factors, immediately you start getting very complex geometry of sedimentation based on erosion and accumulation. And that's the basis of sequence stratigraphy. Okay, so those of us who are not familiar with the history of sequence stratigraphy, I want to introduce you to these three luminaries, three founding fathers of sequence stratigraphy. Peter Vail, now he is a professor emeritus in University of Rice. Bob Mitchum at 86 still works for Chevron, and I had an opportunity to work with him for some time on some Nigeria project. John Sangree, unfortunately, I was checking his profile today and found out like he passed away in 2018, although he was the youngest of the three. And one thing is common of the three figures is they all went to the Northwestern University, okay, and all had PhD under one guy who is Larry Schloss. Now, those of you who remember your textbooks in geology, Larry Schloss was the guy who came up with this concept of mega sequences. He divided the North American continent into five major mega sequences, Suni, Absaroka, and all that. So they were his students. They did their PhD under him, under his guidance. Then they joined Exxon, and for the first time, they started looking at the seismic data that Exxon had collected. And what they could see, interestingly, is how the shorelines were changing over time with the sea level changes. And that gave rise to the concept of sequence stratigraphy. So I'm not going into detail of this sequence stratigraphy concept from the seismic line here, but for those of us who never deal with seismic data, so these are actually timelines, so over and the numbers you see are in milliseconds, so there's a sound going down to the earth, coming back and giving you a marker. And what they could see is like different markers that we have highlighted, and they could see like these markers going back and forth in time, which told them where the shoreline was at that geological time period. Now, I know like those of us who work in the environmental industry will say, oh, what do I have to do with seismic data? We hardly ever see one in our industry. But the importance of looking at seismic data is it has actually changed the way we correlate all subsurface data. So if you look at this seismic section, so those two red lines are two erosional boundaries around conformities. Within that, you can see those blue lines pinching out along that boundary, right? And if you now do a correlation of cores taken from these locations, now you see that sand body, like a yellow sand here, a yellow sand there, and a yellow sand there, and one there. So just like the hypothetical example we showed, you'd be very, very tempted to join them up and say, oh, that's a continuous sand. That's our high flow area, right? But seismic data shows like they pinch out in the direction of the basin along the unconformity. Therefore, you just mimic that and you recorrelate, and now you can see like this sand is not the same sand and not the same sand. And the main importance is like in between these sand bodies, what you have is these confining clay layers, right? So contamination here is not going to that one. So it immediately changes the way you address the contamination when you understand how to correlate it properly. And that kind of idea revolutionized the petroleum industry in the 80s. So it started in the 70s, caught basically fire, the idea caught fire in the early 80s to the 90s. And you see, like, here's an example, like a cross-section done by ARCO at the time in Alaska in Prudhoe Bay. And what you're seeing in this cross-section is a layer take of deposits. So you had all these deposits shown by gamma logs, and you just put one upon another without much understanding of the stratigraphy. And then in 1999, Robert Tayo, also known as Bowtie, used to work for ARCO, he came in and recorrelated with the same data. And now he knows, like, okay, sediments are dipping in the southern direction, so he had all these shingles of sand coming in, and understanding the deposition in a completely different way helped them produce more oil from that field, because now they could predict what's out there, outboard of the data parts. So, to put simply, the main pitfall of lithostratigraphy stratigraphy is you try to join sand with sand and clay with clay and come up with a very simplistic idea of your flow paths. Whereas in sequence stratigraphy, you understand the geology and you know, like, sediments dip in the basin what direction, and you correlate in a completely different way, and your interpretation changes. Now, this is a very neat example from my good friend Bruce Ainsworth, who just did it with just two wells. You can see the major difference in understanding. So what you're doing is showing, So if you were doing lithostratigraphy, you'd have your flow path like that, very simplistic. But if you're doing sequence stratigraphy with the same data set, you would have your flow path completely changing just because of your better understanding of the subsurface. So stop doing lithostratigraphy and let's do sequence stratigraphy. However, I would go back, Ryan. I would say one word of caution. Sequence stratigraphy can be also abused in some cases. So here you can see the most important thing to note is the distance. So this is within 500 meters, the next well. If you had your well just right there within 10 meters, it doesn't matter whether you're doing lithostratigraphy or sequence stratigraphy. Then in that case, sand would join like that. But if there's a long distance within that, they will dip in the seaward direction. Okay, so here I will show you a real example of how stratigraphy is still being done in the environmental industry and how it should be actually done. So this is a published example from Mekong River, Mekong Delta, and we have a cross section A to B going from landward to seaward. And this was published in the Quaternary Science Review, and you can see, like, they did a very detailed phases analysis. By this we mean, like, they understood the deposition environment, like from bay areas to pro delta to delta front to intertidal and all that. So they did a neat job in understanding the faces. But something is wrong with this scenario. Can you say what? They are still doing it pretty layer cake. All these faces have no transition. There's no relation between the pro delta and the delta front. They're just stacked one upon another, just like a layer cake. Sweet, but not true. Okay. Now, I have a very personal story about this section. One day, like, when my professor came to our classroom, like, in 2002, when I was doing my PhD, and showed us this section, he was furious at the environmental people and saying, like, okay, how could they still do cross sections like that? And then he told us, like, oh, let's have it a project, like, let's do the cross section better. So if we go to the next slide, what he did is, like, so Rahangani is a colleague of mine who was also doing a PhD along with me. he took it very seriously, and he said, okay, let me try to recorrelate those in terms of sequence retrieval and phases understanding. So they, in fact, published this paper in 2005 using the same identical data, but there's a big change now. You see, it's no longer a layer cake. You can see, like, the delta front is bringing, so river is bringing in the delta front deposits. They're coming in and going into pro delta. So timeline-wise, sand is in the same timeline with the mud of the pro delta. So this is a redoing of the old data, and you will quite often hear us in ACOM say, like, we can do a lot of the work with the pre-existing data. I mean, it's always good to have new and good data, but even if you don't have new data, you could reuse your old data by looking at it in a different way and bringing a lot of meaning out of it. So the key takeaway from this session of the historical perspective of sequence stratigraphy is, first of all, sequence stratigraphy is not equal to phases analysis, as we just saw in the previous example. That was very good phases work, but without understanding of the sequence stratigraphy aspect. So if you imagine in a metaphor, sequence stratigraphy is basically a skeleton of correlation, and within that, phases is the flesh. So you need both. So the phases is actually the building block within the sequence stratigraphy. So with that, I'll let Ryan take over and teach us some of the concepts of sequence stratigraphy.
Great. Thank you, Junaid. So with that, also, we're going to transition away from Lecture 1 and now into Lecture 2. And as Junaid hinted at, we're going to cover a little bit more of the fundamentals of sequence stratigraphy. Now, with sequence stratigraphy, the most important aspect of it is the idea of accommodation, or the space available for sediment to be preserved. And this accommodation can be created in a number of different ways. So the first is what we call our eustatic sea level. And eustace is generally a worldwide measure of our sea level relative to a fixed point. And usually that fixed point tends to be the center of the Earth, resulting in the global measurement. However, because of local factors such as tectonics or sediment supply, most of the time accommodation tends to be it tends to be measured relative to a more local measure of sea level, which we call our relative sea level, and that tends to be it's a measure of our sea surface to a local fixed datum that can fluctuate either up or down based on a number of different local factors. And to be able to visually represent this, Junaid has a really clever analog.
Well, usually I use this picture for diversity moments, showing like how the daily commute is in Bangladesh, and to make you guys feel happy, those of us who live in North America or the or Europe, how good our commute is. But apart from that, the other significance of this figure, why I put it here. So imagine, so this is a metro in my home country, Bangladesh. So imagine even that train at some point is totally empty. That's the time when you have full accommodation. That gets filled in pretty soon because of the high population density in Dhaka, in my capital. And then people start climbing up. As you can see, like, they're doing a good job there. But then, like, if you go up and try to stand here, you'll be trampled. You better, like, that wise guy here, like, walking towards that direction. So you start moving forward to make more space. And this is a perfect analogy for several situations, what you see in accommodation versus supply. So when the accommodation is filled, and then it keeps pace with increasing accommodation, what we call is aggregation or vertical growth. So like these people climbing vertically. And then when people are moving forward, it's very similar to what we call progradation, or movement of sediments towards the sea. So this is a good analogy I use for all these scenarios.
Thank you, Gina. I wonder how the people would feel if they knew they were being used as an analog for geology.
They have no clue.
So, you know, as Junaid kind of mentioned there in that analogy, there's a number of different factors that influence the subsurface stratigraphy beneath each of our sites. And really what it boils down to is this really complex interplay between sediment supply and accommodation. However, these two factors in themselves are also the product of other regional influences. So for example, accommodation, or again, the space available for our sediment to be preserved, is the product of both our eustatic sea level and our tectonic influence. So for example, if sea level is high and there's substantial subsidence at our site, then it's more likely that our sediment will be preserved. And if sea level is low and there's considerable uplift, say for example by isostatic rebound, then it's less likely that our sediment will be preserved. But on the other hand, when we think about the sedimentary supply component here, it's primarily driven by our tectonic and then our climatic factors. So in a dry climate and a relatively flat topography, we generally expect less sediment. Whereas in a wet environment next to a mountain, for example, we would expect more sediment. So in this presentation, although we're largely going to focus on our coastal settings, this interplay between accommodation and supply is also what drives our ability to correlate in a number of other different depositional environments. So diving a little bit deeper about each one of these factors, we're going to highlight the first, or eustatic sea level change. And what you're seeing here is that through time, there are a number of different orders of sea level change through time. And importantly, each time sea level goes down, erosion occurs because of lack of accommodation. And the net result here is that it can result in significant time gaps within our stratigraphic column. So in order to understand the stratigraphic relationships beneath our site, it's also essential that we understand these gaps in time and understand our sea level curve. And in our industry, since we primarily deal with relatively shallow sediments, we're primarily focused within the shallow quaternary deposits. So this sea level curve here. So roughly the last 400,000 years. And, you know, in order to better understand how sea level changes can impact the movement of our coastline and our sediment distribution, it's also important that we understand some of the basic principles behind this. And what we're going to focus on is this concept of Walther's Law, which states that any vertical progression of facies is the result of succession of a depositional environment that are laterally juxtaposed to each other. But it's also important to note here that Walther's Law only works as long as there are no unconformities. So to kind of demonstrate this in action, what you're seeing here is kind of a plan view map showing a lateral distribution of facies, going from a sandy beach environment close to our shoreline, and then gradationally shifting to kind of shallow marine limestone facies as we get further seaward. And what you're seeing on the right-hand side here is a series of time steps that are showing land and sea. So if we're to start at time one, we see that these facies are in roughly the same orientation. And through time, we see that this system is gradationally moving seaward. And the net result here is an overall coarsening upward succession of what we can define as coastal progradation. So this is a seaward movement of the coastline. On the other hand, if we were to start off with time one and we were to notice an overall landward movement of the coastline, this might overall result in a net fining upward succession, or what we call retrogradation, so a landward movement of the coastline. And what's important here is that these stacking patterns can ultimately dictate the connectivity, the distribution, and ultimately the vertical slash lateral relationships of storage and transmissive units. So for example, if we were to start off in this top example here, during progradation, or basically a seaward movement of the coastline, our sediment supply exceeds our accommodation. And as a result, we have an overall coarsening upward vertical trend and then an increased connectivity of our high K SAN bodies. So what you're seeing on the left is a cartoon of how this thing, how the system is moving seaward through time. And on the right-hand side, you're seeing a vertical well log response of this overall system movement. On the second example, in retrogradation, again, this landward movement of our coastline, we can see that sediment supply is less than accommodation. And as a result, although there's an overall finding upward vertical trend, the sand bodies also react and become increasingly thinner and become increasingly mud encapsulated. And then finally, during aggradation, where there's no net movement of the coastline, so it's pretty much stacking on top of each other, we can see that sediment supply is roughly equal to accommodation. So therefore, there's no real trend that's observed between the thickness and the continuity of the sand bodies. But critically, when we compare these three scenarios, we can see that the progradational sand bodies generally have the highest lateral and vertical connectivity, whereas the retrogradational sand bodies are generally isolated, thinner, and mud encapsulated, which could result in an overall lower overall connectivity. So each one of these scenarios is going to influence potential water and contaminant flow migrations, depending on the scenario that we're dealing with within our, beneath our particular site. And to better visualize how this process is going, is Gene's going to pull up a movie. So I'm gonna let this play here, and you know, to better observe how these processes work in action, what you're seeing here is a delta tank experiment that I did during my graduate research. So this tank that you're seeing, it's about 0.65 meters deep, 4.2 meters long, and 2.8 meters meters wide. And the movie itself was created by taking a series of snapshots and stitching them together through time. So you might notice the little stop clock in the bottom left-hand corner. There's a sediment feeder up towards the north that delivers sediment and water into this basin. And you can also see that base level at the very bottom is controlled by a motorized weir that's in hydraulic communication with this tank. And base level, the sediment input, and the water level in the basin are all controlled by this computer interface that isn't shown here in this image. And critically, the two key components that you're seeing are change in base level, which is this top kind of little curve, and you have sediment flux, which is the bottom curve. So you'll see that each of these little pulses is representative of a flash flooding event. But what I want you to pay attention to is that during the steady state or aggradational phase, is that we can observe several really important processes. The first is that we have this overall gradational finding away from the sediment source. So the yellows are representative of our sands, and the grays are representative of our clays. We can also see that there's delta lobe migration and switching that's common. It can rework some of this previously deposited sediment. And then finally, and I want to point this out here now, is that each one of these delta lobes, as we advance within the slides, we're going to be using the term parasequence. So each parasequence is equivalent to each one of these progradational delta lobes. So for the sake of time here, I'm going to quickly jump ahead into this movie, just to the point where we're now going to have a shift in our base level. And as we can see, you know, as base level is beginning to rise, we're going to notice that the same geomorphic processes are still working, but because sediment supply itself is not able to keep up with this change in accommodation, i.e. there's more space for the sediment to be preserved, the overall result is this net backstepping or retrogradation of the system. But you can still have local progradation of each delta lobe as it's hitting the sediment water interface. And then finally, you know, as we're starting to hit this turnaround point, where we're going from rising sea level to a falling sea level, now we can see that the space available for sediment accumulation has been removed. And now there's an overall seaward movement of the shoreline or an overall progradation within our system. So with that, Gene, let's go back to the slide deck. Thank you. So what you're seeing here now is that, so you just saw this animation at play. And now what we did was we took a vertical slice through this system, which is represented here by this yellow line on the right. So we're quite literally taking a dip section through this system. And what's important about this is that there are a couple really important characteristics that we can point out within the sediment slice. First is that when we go from land to sea, so land being on the right and sea being towards the left, we can see, again, this overall gradation of our sediment. So it's generally coarser, closer to our land source, and we see this gradational fining or increase in percentage of mud as we move further seaward. Another important observation you might notice is that we have this interfingering, more seaward, between sand bodies and clays. And you might also notice that in some cases you have these laterally continuous, really thick clays that can extend throughout the entire system. So overall, what we're seeing here is an interplay between flooding and progradation through time. Overall, defining each one of these individual stacked sequence sets. So this is the dip section, and now what we're going to observe is a strike section. So again, this section is was cut right at the sediment-water interface, and it's representative of the strike. And it might be a little bit difficult to see in this image, but when we put an overlay representative of the individual lithologies that we're seeing, with blues being representative of our clays, these thin blue lines are representative of our channel scours, and then these whites being representative of our sandy deposits, we can clearly see that in the strike orientation, not all of these clays are connected to each other. So in this setting, it becomes critical that we understand that we're not using, if we were to use lithostratigraphy, and say if we were to drill one well here and another well over here, it's likely that we'd see this sandy or this clay deposit here and this clay deposit here, and likely we'd want to correlate the two between. And when it comes to designing our remedial strategies and understanding potential groundwater flow pathways, in this assumption, we probably would be assuming a laterally continuous confining unit. But we can see, based off of this depositional system, is that outside of these well points, there's a really vast potential vertical migration pathway for our contaminants that may have otherwise been disregarded in our initial well network. So with that, I'm also going to play another animation here. And so what you're going to see here, and the purpose of this video that you're going to see here, is to really kind of help to communicate how our vertical subsurface data that we collect at our site is ultimately a reflection of our lateral sediment relationships through time. Thanks. So perfect. So Gene pulled up an animation here. Before I dive into the video, I just want to have the still frame up here so I can walk you through exactly what you're going to see. So on the bottom left-hand side, you're seeing a representation of our vertical subsurface data. And in this case, we're seeing some continuous downhole geophysical data, or SP or resistivity logs. On the bottom right-hand side, you're seeing a reflection of our sea level curve through time. So generally, reflections to the left are indicative of our high sea level, whereas reflections to the right are indicative of our lower sea level. And then the top image is going to show us a plan view cartoon that will show how the spatial distribution of our depositional environment is ultimately reflected in the subsurface. I also want to give a great thank you to Chris Kendall for allowing us to use this video to demonstrate this. So as I play this, generally you'll notice that sea level moves to the right, or when it's falling, we'll have an overall progradation of our system and the deposition of laterally continuous sand. Whereas on the other hand, as sea level is moving towards the left, we see an overall drowning of our system and the deposition of laterally continuous clays. And in the scenarios, as you just observed there, where we have sea level that drops exceptionally fast, we see that there's potential for incision through our previously deposited sediments. So the purpose of showing you this animation here is that understanding our sea level curve helps to make these sediment relationships predictable. And it's also important to understand that our log signatures that we're capturing at our site is the result of all these inputs being preserved through time. So because this was a really quick video, I'm going to play this through one last time, and hopefully you can capture some of the things I just mentioned in that first run through. Great. Gene, if you could hand it back over to the slide deck. Thanks. So you just saw a couple animations of how these inputs are interacting with each other and how they ultimately influence the subsurface sedimentary architecture. But now we're going to break down the sea level curve into each of its individual components. So what you see here is a representation of our sea level curve through time, with low sea level being at the bottom and highest level sea level being at the top, and then time progressively moving towards the right. So our sea level curve itself can be divided into four different what we call system tracks, which themselves reflect the change in the rate of the overall sea level rise or fall through time. So if we start off with this green system track, this is what we call our transgressive system track. And this is a reflection of a very fast sea level rise through time. The high stand system track marks the transition from our transgressive system track to our low stand, and it results in an overall change or turning point within the sea level curve. We then get into our falling stage system track, which similar to the transgressive system track, reflects a very fast rate of change, or in this case, it's a fast rate of sea level fall, and then it ultimately results in the low stand system track, which, similar to the high stand system track, is a turnaround from this fast to a relatively lower rate of change. And critically, when it comes to understanding and doing our sequence stratigraphic correlation, it's important that we define a couple key markers within the sea level curve. The first one being our maximum flooding surface. Just as you observed in that delta tank experiment, our maximum flooding surface are these thick, laterally continuous muds that are separating each one of these otherwise sandy bodies. And generally, this is a reflection of the transition from the transgressive systems track to the high stand. So when it comes to our correlation, the maximum flooding surface is critical to use as our datum for correlation. The stratigraphic marker that denotes the high stand to the falling stand system track is what's called our basal surface of forced regression. The separation between the falling stage systems track and the low stand systems track is our sequence boundary. And our sequence boundary is also equivalent to our unconformity, or our surface of erosion. And finally, the separation between the low stand and the transgressive systems track is our transgressive surface. So it's critical at this point that we define that a sequence has a very specific definition. And that is that it's a series of these genetically related sediments that are bounded by these unconformities. So when we're doing sequence stratigraphy, we quite literally are correlating each one of these sequences. And it's also important to point out here that in our industry, we tend to overuse the word sequence. In some cases, we say sequence, when in reality, we mean to say succession, to represent vertical shifts in our grain size trends. And to demonstrate how our understanding of the sea level curve reflects our understanding of the lateral distribution of our sediments, I'm going to walk you through some regional facies models for each one of these systems tracks. So starting off on our Louisiana systems track, I want you to pay attention to this little boat here on the right and overall sea level. So at this point, we can see that the boat is relatively far to the right or furthest seaward, and we're dealing with an overall low sea level. And the net result here is an overall progradation of our coastline, our movement towards the sea. As we eventually work our way into the transgressive systems track, we can see that now the boat is much further landward. And there's been a significant flooding of what was the previous shoreline. Also important to point out here is that there's a pretty significant change in our coastline geomorphology. So that rather than dealing with a general progradational deltaic system, now we have the development of barrier islands and back barrier lagoons. As we continue our way along the cycle of deposition, now we work our way into high stand, and we see, again, we have an overall progradation within our system. So you can see the overall turnaround going from transgression, the overall deposition of our fine-grained shale separating previous sand bodies, and the overarching encroaching high stand deltaic deposits. And then finally, as we work our way into the falling stage systems track, we see a significant very rapid drop in our base level, resulting in the formation of incised valleys and significant progradation of the coastline through time. In this cycle, in this example, this assumes a constant sediment supply, and the only variable being changed is base level rise and fall. But in theory, this cycle would repeat itself continuously through time at a variety of different magnitudes. And the net result of that is something that might look like this. And we're not going to go into a great amount of detail here, but what we're showing you is that an understanding of sequence stratigraphy, and although the concepts themselves might be relatively simple, when putting it into practice and doing it within our correlation, it becomes much more complex. And being able to properly identify these significant markers takes a lot of time and a lot of experience to be able to do. So you'll notice, and just quickly running through this, each one of these key stratigraphic markers that are defined within this slug model. And with that, we're going to work our way back into a thought exercise and how we can apply this within our site-specific data.
All right, so punishment time. I think Ryan has already taught you sequence stratigraphy, and you'll be able to answer all the questions, right? Well, even if not, we can start thinking about all these sequence boundaries and the systems track that Ryan discussed. So let's think of a scenario here. This is taken from Henry Passamentier's book. I just made it into an exercise. So think of three well locations, A, B, and C. In B, you see a thick channelized unit, a sand body, and it's finding up, whereas A and C shows all these coursing up successions. So, and this wiggly line represents a major erosion occurring. So now you already know, like, erosion occurs when the sea level is falling, right? So what we're trying to do here is trying to understand, like, what that marker is. So we have some arrows, right? So what's the blue marker and that green marker? So the first one, so what would be at the base of that channel, that erosion? Okay, I think you got it right, it's sequence boundary. So that's the boundary of a sequence. And then you can see that blue marker, following that, you have everything getting muddy all around. So that's a transgression. So we have a transgressive surface there. And lastly, but not the least, you see a turnaround part that Ryan mentioned, like from the muddiness, you're going back to sandiness again. What would you call that? That's the maximum flooding surface. So these are the three major markers we work with in sequence stratigraphy. And now, if you're trying to look at the system stress caused by that, let's see those. Yeah, so the lower one is the high stand system stress upon which you have your sequence boundary, right? And then the next stage is the low stand system stress, which is that portion right on top of the sequence boundary. And then you have that muddy area where transgression has occurred. So therefore, we call it the transgressive systems track. And following that turnaround, what do you call it? Yes, the HST coming back again. Brilliant. I'm very impressed by your performance. Okay, let's move on. So Ryan also mentioned something called parasequences when he was showing the tank model. So we are seeing some real example of parasequences here. So on this side, you're seeing a gamma log response. So the arrow is showing coursing up successions here. Remember, not sequences, but successions. And within that, our chord interval is from here. So you can see a bit of one coursing up and the second coursing up there. And if you look at the chord response, you see from muddiness, it becoming sandy, and then suddenly, boom, that's a parasequence boundary getting muddy there. And then from muddiness, it becomes sandy again, and on top of it, you have that surface represented here. Following that, you have that mud coming in. So parasequences are all these deltaic lobes with mud in between. So, and this is not just a just something that you interpret from core, from the outcrop. Like here you can see my good friend Cornell standing beside my PhD outcrop area, Wall Creek Formation, Wall Creek member of Frontier Formation. And if you click, we'll see each of these parasequences. So all these deltaic lobes topped by a mud, and then that mud goes into sand again, it becomes muddy again. So the significance of understanding parasequences is, like, suppose you're working in a deltaic setting in an environmental project, you will look for these mud markers because they will be pretty continuous confining units within the deltaic succession. Okay, so finally, like, I'll walk you through the way we try to correlate applying sequence stratigraphy. By the way, this again is from Catania's book of sequence stratigraphy. I just made some animations to make our point and exercise. So here, first of all, I would emphasize that note any phases description. Whenever you're working with your data, you first have to understand the depositional environment. That may come from borehole data, that may come from regional understanding, looking at Google Earth images, and having a full understanding of what you can see. So for example, you have here fluvial deposits, followed by marine, then deltaic, and fluvial again. And these gamma logs, are what they're showing is deflection to the left is sandy, deflection to the right is muddy. So we know, like, we are interested, and the interesting point is, like, this is the base inward direction. So whatever sediment is coming from here is going in that direction. With that idea, let's try to correlate. Okay, so what we're doing here, first of all, we're trying to see, okay, this is a coursing up succession, another one, and another one. And now you also have a term for those, right? You call them parasequences. So basically, you're seeing three parasequences here, three here, and two here. And now the challenge is, one of the parasequences is disappearing. But which one? How do you know that? So the approach in sequence stratigraphy is, although at end of the day we're interested in the flow units in the sands here, but we don't look at the sands first. We look at all the bounding surfaces that Ryan described. So let's find the first significant surface we can find. So that's a significant surface from which you have a turnaround, all the deltas are coming in, and we call that a maximum flooding surface. And you see, like, even below that, from fluvial, there's suddenly marine, so you're getting into a drowning condition. So we should find another marker, which we call transgressive surface, right? And then on top of these deltaic lobes, you see one thing from delta to you are having fluvial deposits. So you are getting into a sequence boundary there. So now you have all your major markers, but you also see other markers there, which are the clay layers, which we call flooding surfaces. So if you click on those, so we try to identify each of these flooding surfaces, and now we know everything is moving basinward, so they should be dipping basinward, and we join it like that. Okay, now you have your skeleton, your framework. Now, the final thing you've got to do is put in the faces, so let's do that. So you have one, tongue, three, two, three, all these sediments at the delta lobe movement in the basinward direction, so you that's marine, and this is sand, and this is clay. So that's how you do your sequence retrieval. Okay.
So with that, I think we'll take a 5-minute Q&A session, because I'm sure we've gone through a lot of really dense material, and I'm sure that there are plenty of questions out there.
All right. I'll remind the audience that Q&A window is available in the bottom corner of your screen. We are about 10 minutes after 2 p.m. Eastern, just for a quick time check for everybody. But I will take one or two questions now, and then we'll carry on. One of the questions that came in earlier in the talk was how you would apply some of the rules you were discussing to delineate the past occurrence of a bolide event, which I would believe a meteor might be hitting the ground. Can you talk about how you might use those in those situations?
I don't think that that sequence stratigraphy would apply in that scenario if a meteor were hitting the ground, primarily because of significant deformation and also because of significant chemical processes that would be entirely reworked the subsurface.
Okay. And one of the participants asked, how does sediment deposition above the, quote, maximum flooding surface occur?
Yeah, so maximum flooding surface, as we mentioned, is the turnaround point. So imagine the coastline has moved maximum towards the land, and after that, what happens in this turnaround above the maximum flooding surface, you have deltaic deposits coming in, because after the maximum flooding surface, you have the high stand scenario, where the sea level is from rising to falling pretty rapidly, and within that time, you have deltas going in the seaward direction.
Right, I think, to build off of that, I think it comes down to the rate in which sea level is moving. So, at high stand, you still have a relatively high sea level and a space available for sediment accumulation, but it's just an overall change in rate in which the sea level is changing.
Okay. And then very quickly, we've had a number of questions come in about the scale of some of the models that you've been showing or highlighting. Do you have, are they a rough approximation for the horizontal scale for these models?
Yeah, I think that as we get into the case studies here, you'll be able to see some of the scales a little bit better. But I will say,
in general, like, we are thinking large scale here, so in terms of miles. So sometimes the issue is you are just looking at your site, which is maybe very small, like a gas station size area. And then you may ask, like, does sequence stratigraphy still apply here? Well, it still applies because you have to look at it regionally. If you're just looking at it locally, you will miss some of the heterogeneities that would be there because of the local impacts. So therefore, we got to do regional studies in every place where we work, and that's several miles long at least.
Okay. All right, I think in the interest of time, we'll go ahead and resume with the presentation. But for those of you who've sent in additional questions, they are still in the queue, and we'll come back to those later on when we take our second Q&A break.
Great, thank you. So with that, we'll move on to lecture three. And again, so we covered the difference between sequence stratigraphy and lithostratigraphy. We went through some of the fundamentals, and now we want to show you how it can be successfully applied to remediate these sites. So the first thing that I want to do is introduce PRISM. And PRISM stands for Predictive Integrated Stratigraphic Modeling. And PRISM is AECOM's fully integrated conceptual site model brand. And what's important about it is that it's integrating not only geology, hydrology, and chemistry, but it's using sequence stratigraphy and bringing to forefront sequence stratigraphy as the basis for reinterpreting our groundwater and chemical flow. And, you know, integration as a general concept is really nothing new to our industry. But in reality, most of these parameters are generally treated separately and are siloed. So what we want to do here and what we've done is just for the sake of time, we on the left-hand side, we put together a general workflow that we feel is generally applicable to the industry itself. But the couple key takeaways that I want you to glean from this workflow is that sequence stratigraphy by itself, while valuable, doesn't really add too much value. It itself is not the answer to our problems. But when put in the context of reevaluating our groundwater and chemistry flow, then it becomes a really important management tool. And then the second key takeaway is that it's important for us to analyze our site-specific data on a variety of scales. So not only just focusing on what's beneath our site, but putting it within the context of the regional system. Sorry about that. Just to kind of expand upon that last point here, is that we successfully applied PRISM to a number of different reasons that are listed on the left-hand side. But what we're going to do here is go into a number of different case studies that will demonstrate each one of these individual bullets. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'll hand it back over to Chinayan. But I will say that what you're going to see here in the overall case studies is an overall progression in how we're using them. So the first one is going to demonstrate how sequence stratigraphy can be successfully applied. The second one is going to be used to demonstrate how sequence stratigraphy can be used to design a more effective remedial strategy. And then the third one is going to demonstrate how sequence stratigraphy and a holistic CSM can benefit all stakeholders involved in a remedial project.
All right, so thank you, Ryan. So this is a case study that I want to share with you. It's the Pushak Wellfield Superfund site where we have recently worked. And in fact, I would also like to add that this project has been selected for EPA Headquarter Accomplishment Report for 2019. So let's go into the project, and starting with the problem issue here. So this is the site of metallic contamination. There has been high hexavalent chromium contamination at various levels of depth at the site in New Jersey. And there have been attempts of remediation, injections have been done, but still there is poor understanding of the subsurface. And therefore, the goal is to understand the internal heterogeneity at the site using sequence stratigraphy. Especially since it's in a coastal setting, it's a perfect place for sequence stratigraphy. And then we also wanted to look at the impact of present injections in mitigating the contamination, where they're being done, and if it's being effective, and help EPA come up with a predictive remedial strategy for the site. So a little bit about the site location. That's the Pushak Well field location in New Jersey. And this is within Cretaceous sediments. The aquifer is in Cretaceous Magothi sediments. Also, I want to point out something, like we always build upon our previous knowledge. We have worked in Bethpage and Hercules, two other sites, and also Plainview, another site we have worked on recently, all in the same setting, which gives them more confidence of doing stratigraphy here. And you can see the sections we have drawn. So there are four sections, stratigraphic sections, we drew in this area. So before we get into the stratigraphy, let's look at the aquifer we are interested in. We are interested in the Magothi aquifer of Upper Cretaceous, highlighted by red. That's Camden, where our site is, and that's the location there. So, as Ryan showed, especially if you are in the coastal area, your accommodation is pretty much dependent upon how your sea level behaved over time. And what you can see here is sea level 0 to 100. That means our area of interest is in the Magothi formation of the Turonian time. And you can see the sea level has overall fallen. So you have a general progradation going on. But also within that scenario, you have some retrogradation or backstepping as the high frequency sea level curve shows. And by now you're already familiar with these Chris Kendall diagrams of different scenarios. And what we will see in our project is a setting of high stand going into low stand, transgressive, and high stand again. Basically, we will see slivers of two cycles of deposits like that. And as we mentioned, like, it's not just understanding the sequence and sea level curves, also understanding the phases within them. And for that, we have gamma logs for the site. And the gamma log response here, you can see the API values there. So these are representing fanning up successions, which is what you would expect in a fluvial setting, as these models suggest. And basically what we're talking about here is pond bar deposits. Like, this is an outcrop image from another site we have worked, but it's a good analog for describing your fanning up successions. And we don't just get fanning up successions, we're also getting blocky to coarsening up successions, as you can see in this gamma log, and they are representative of deltaic deposits, deltaic mud bars, which are stacked. And those of us who are not very familiar with these geological terms, so mud bars are basically what the river dumps at the mouth of the river, at the mouth of it, within a open body of water. In this particular case, this is a lake example, but a good analog of what you'd see, like, there's a subaerial portion and a subaqueous portion of that, and those are the sediments we call delta mud bars. So understanding the phases, understanding the sea level, how it was behaving during that time, we were able to develop these two deep sections. Once again, so all these yellow sediments you're seeing, these are delta mud bar deposits. It's dipping in that direction, you can see that angle, followed by a sequence boundary, which is that erosional deposit, and those are the channelized, the orange deposits, the channels on top of it, followed by estuarine conditions during transgression. And then again, you have a second cycle of delta mud bar after the maximum flooding surface coming in, and followed by yet another erosion. So these are two deep sections, and we'll now also look at strike sections. So now we're looking at these pink and blue sections, which are the strike. So the coastline is around that area. Coastline is around that area. So these are strike sections. And one thing you see, like, right now, what you're seeing here, if you're not a geologist for your understanding, the channels are coming towards you. So these are the erosional boundaries of the channels. Also, the delta mouth bars are coming towards you. So they look like mounds with some wings, and Ryan often calls them bat wings. So they are like bat wing fissures. You can see that means delta is coming towards you. So now that you have got all your sections, it's always good to put them in a 3D perspective for better understanding. Now we can see, like, this is landward, that's basinward. So sediment, the deltas are moving in this direction. And the channel bars, interesting thing about channel bars in three dimensions, you see, like, you don't see any stacking of channels in this direction, whereas you can see the channel bars are stacking perpendicular to the flow direction. And that is what happens in lateral accretion. So in lateral accretion, or the pond bar deposits, they go perpendicular to the flow direction. So now we know the flow direction, we know the high K and the low K zones, and we know their behavior pattern. So now we will look at how contamination behaves within that. So here we have just zoomed in into this area of the 3D cross-section, and you can see we have just highlighted the high contaminated areas. And you can see like they're actually placed on the sequence boundary in these channelized units in the lower one. And in the upper area, you have contamination sometimes, but pretty low in number. If you click here, so you can see like basically that channel is actually that channel. It's the same thing, same sand body. Only thing is that we don't have data there. That one is related to this one. So by putting them in three-dimensional context, you start to understand how the contamination is behaving in the subsurface. Also, now we are zooming into a different location within that 3D fence diagram. And now we can see, like, so this is your dip direction. So all the delta malba dipping in that way. You see the bird's wing in this direction. So this is coming towards you. And these are orange are the channel bars. And now you can see they are all lined up. And if we click now, we can see how the plume can be now construed based on these data points. Okay. So what conclusions we make from this? Let's go to the next one. Okay, so no, let's go back maybe again. Yeah, so basically what we are seeing is the high contamination zone is in the channels on the lower sequence boundary, and all these delta malpa deposits, they're quite often devoid of contamination. There is one or two cases with still relatively low number of contamination within the mouth bars. Next one. So also the other thing is like doing the correlation helps you understand the transmissivity and connectivity of the deposits. We found out the fluvial corn bars have the highest transmissivity but low connectivity. Mouth bars have moderate to high connectivity and as well as high transmissivity. And tidal bars, overbanks, and prodelta muds and estuarine muds are progressively having lesser and lesser permeability, and although they have high continuity, so those are our confining units, the prodelta mud and the estuarine mud. Also, when we say like low connectivity or high connectivity, what do they mean? Based on our data, we came up with numbers of what would high mean and what would low mean, and also come up with numbers of like how thick the channel bars are, how thick the mouth bars are, and understand like how each of these systems tracks are. So basically dissecting our data set in a sequence stratigraphy perspective, understanding its phase architecture in detail. What it did is it gave us a better understanding of how the present remediation is working, and we could see like the high chromium contamination is still in the lower channel bar deposits of sequence boundary one. Also, we see like the delta malpa deposits above the channelized unit, they show low values of contamination with some rare exceptions. Therefore, we are concluding that most likely the injection that was operated here worked pretty well because the mouth bars are easy to tackle, but when it comes to the lower channels, we need to focus on those. And because now we could give them the dimensions of these channel bars and the thickness and their connectivity, they can now have a more focused remedial strategy. So that was my first case study.
Hey, thanks, Junaid. So with that now, we're going to move on to our second case study, which in this example will demonstrate how we can use that new interpretation to evaluate an existing remedial strategy. So we're going to focus down on Hill Air Force Base, which is located in Salt Lake City, Utah. So the site itself, it's a pretty high priority site because of the TCE plume that's moving from the base itself and moving towards the north into a residential neighborhood. And generally, overall, although there's an extensive well network, all except for two wells have historically been exhibiting an overall downward trend. So the problem here was that they had an off-base pump and treat system that was not treating the northern lobe of this plume and was not meeting their RRD required RTF. And the goals here were to evaluate the effectiveness of that previous remedy, which in this case was a combination of the pump and treat and MNA, and then use that information to augment or modify that existing remedy as necessary. So just like in a coastal environment, sequence stratigraphy can also be applicable in a lacustrine environment because of this interplay between accommodation and sediment supply. And although today the Great Salt Lake is a very large lake, it's actually only a small remnant of once much larger Lake Bonneville, which is the paleo extent is shown here on the right-hand side. And the approximate location of Hill is located by the red star. And although we won't go into it in this presentation, there's a really great animation that you can click on here that's presented by the Utah Geological Society, where they go through the paleo reconstruction of Lake Bonneville. But for our purposes, we're going to focus on two distinct lake levels: the Bonneville, which was the maximum lake level, and then the Provo, which was followed by a very rapid, sharp lake level decline. And if we were to zoom in into our site-specific area, and again focus on the Bonneville and Provo shorelines, we can see that during the Bonneville, our base was actually completely submerged underwater. And subsequently, during the Provo, it was subaerially exposed. So in order to think about this, you can think of a modern-day system. If you have a river that's entering into a much larger water body, what you get is the formation of a deltaic system. And then if you have a really rapid lake level fall, you have truncation or incision through that previous deltaic sediment. And what's cool about this is that you can even see this formation by using Google Earth imagery. So on the far right here, we have our Wasatch Mountains. We can see this delta front facies of where upon which Hill Air Force Base lies. And then we have our pro-deltaic sediments as we progressively move towards the west until we finally hit our Provo shoreline. So what's critical about this is that, one, we know that our deltaic system emanates from the east and is depositing towards the west. And perhaps even more importantly, is that we haven't even looked at our site-specific data, but we've already created a regional framework of what we should expect to be exhibited beneath this site. You know, we just spent an hour talking about how deltaic systems act, right? So we'd have a series of these stacked parasequences that are, in this case, moving towards to the west, to the northwest. And our particular site, OU6, is located right here. There's this really sharp, really steep elevational change caused by this Weber River incised valley. So because we've established a regional framework and we know what this should look like, it allows us to have a framework upon which to evaluate the pre-existing data. And what we can see is that this north-south trending cross-section it goes right through the heart of the plume. And what's critical about this is that at the base here, they define a relatively, relatively continuous dipping clay layer that's dipping from the south to the north. And what's important about that is that you can see that their entire remedial system was designed upon this dipping clay layer. But we took this exact same data and we reinterpreted it. And now what you're seeing here is a series of these thick, laterally extensive clay units at the bottom, which is representative of that paleo Bonneville maximum flooding surface. And then you have these stacked delta lobes that are gradationally finding a way and migrating towards the north in this case. So what you're seeing here are that the well logs themselves and the screens have been color-coded so that they match the contamination values depicted here in the Plan View plume map. So blues are representative of TC between 5 and 10 UGLs, greens are greater than 10, and whites are below MCL. And then we've also highlighted the remedial network, so that the blues are representative of the extraction wells, and then the reds are wells representative that have an overall increasing trend. As I mentioned at the outset, all wells except for these two wells exhibit an overall historic downward finding or a downward trend. But what immediately jumps out in this reinterpretation is that the wells that exhibited this overall downward trend, it's clear that the existing well network doesn't necessarily capture these high K laterally extensive mouth bar deposits, and therefore the existing well network might not actually be capturing the full extent of this plume. Even more so is that when we examine whether wells are screened relative to this new interpretation, is that we can see that the wells with increasing trends the one closest to the source exhibits the potential for cross-contamination, whereas the one further down gradient within the residential neighborhood is screened deeper than some of the existing well network. And we can also use this reinterpretation to really evaluate these pre-existing data gaps. So just to quickly run through this and highlight a few, is that we can see that, again, the deeper deltaics are not fully delineated. We can see that the existing pump and treat extractions are screened across multiple intervals and might not be capturing the full extent of that contamination. And we can also see and examine this through an overall decline in the water table through time, suggesting that our hydraulic flow will be, and our relative to our well networks, will significantly impact the performance of this existing pump and treat system. And when we compare that to a cross-section that was created in the residential neighborhood, so now you're looking at a strike section. And because of these delta lobes are migrating and prograding into this otherwise continuous thick lacustrine unit, they can create basal scour, which in itself can act as a natural geologic constraint. So again, using these same parameters and comparing where our plume lies relative to the existing well network, we can then examine some additional data gaps. Specifically, we can see that in some cases, the water level above the bottom of the aquifer is missing the high mass within the contaminant system. Also, as we move away from the basal scour, we can see that the overall saturated thickness significantly declines. And then finally, interestingly enough, when we compare the well screens relative to where the mass is, the only well that exhibits this overall increasing trend is the only well that appears to be placed properly to capture the most mass. So all said and done, all of this information can then be used in order to synthesize potential remedial strategies. So based on some of the data gaps that we've evaluated, some of the key things that we want to do we really want to be able to vertically profile that aquifer with some continuous boring logs. It would be especially critical that we at least have one of those boring logs hitting the bottom of the bathtub or that really thick lacustrine unit to be able to validate the potential extent of that plume. And also to install some of these monitoring wells in order to overall enhance that conceptual site model and fill out some of the downward vertical vertical grain sizes. When it comes to evaluating that off-base plume evaluation, we have HRSC tools like CPT that are really great at being able to get out there and sample some of these discrete intervals to be able to characterize some of the groundwater. And also to use some of these high-resolution tools to be able to analyze this plume at a really high resolution. And then think about this thing in terms of some of the hydraulic evaluations that we might want answered. It would be important that we reevaluate this plume and compare it between pumping and non-pumping conditions to see the true effect of that pump and treat system, especially if that pump and treat system isn't properly placed. And also, it would be interesting to see to evaluate that performance relative to the overall decline in groundwater through time because of an overall regional drought. And then some additional considerations are that you might want to do some leading edge sampling on the non-pumping conditions, or even reassess the size and polygons to examine that off-base migration. So although we haven't demonstrated although we haven't demonstrated each one of those actions on this plume, we're just showing you and giving you an example of how this knowledge of our data gap can help influence and design an effective remedial strategy and be used as a proper management tool for consideration of future remedial decisions. And then finally, that leads us to our third and final case study. And in this case, now we're going to show you how sequence stratigraphy can be used to develop a really great 3D visualization technique and its potential benefits to the stakeholders involved. So Joint Base Anacostia Bowling is located just to the south of Washington, D.C., along the Atlantic Coastal Plain. And it itself lies at the confluence between the Anacostia River and the Potomac River. And this is a really mature site, so they had a lot of pre-existing data. So we used some of that pre-existing data. In this case, they had a lot of HBT, CBT logs to develop four different cross sections along the length of the base. But before we get into the cross sections, it's important that we first take a closer look at the problem at hand. And first, first off, what we can see are that there appear to be multiple plumes at this site. And one appears to be at the bank of the Potomac River, and then one appears to migrate towards the north. And what's interesting about this is that since the Potomac River is our major surface water body, our immediate inclination would be that groundwater flow would be towards, in this case, from right to left into the Potomac River. So then why is this plume migrating towards the north? Is there some sort of constraint there that might be causing that northward movement of the plume? And then second, is it possible to use this interpretation of the plume to reevaluate mass flux or mass discharge in this system? So in order to answer those couple questions, we used that pre-existing data, we updated an EVS model, and used that to design a targeted investigative approach. So just to give you a quick glimpse of the previous EVS model, and what you're seeing here, that the colors, these vertical colors here are representative K data. And then you're seeing a creeping between points where the browns are representative of low K, the blues are representative of high K, and the plume outline is highlighted to the right in this mound-like main feature. So we took this pre-existing data, and now we started our regional evaluation. And when we did this, we were really lucky where we came across an academic paper that was conducted by Sato et al. In 2013. And this paper happened to be conducted right at Poplar Point, just to the north of our site. And in this paper, what they deduced was that the Anacostia River Valley actually formed under the influence of this extensional tectonic activity, or what we call a horse and graben system. And it was then bound by these normal faults in both the northern and then the southern side, which ultimately resulted in the tectonic constraint of the river system. So for those of you who are not a geologist, just a quick run through what a horse and graben system is. And again, it's this extensional tectonic system. And it's tectonically induced, and the graben itself are these down-thrown blocks that are bounded on both sides by these normal faults. And in this system, and particularly, these normal faults act as natural barriers to groundwater flow, whereas the horse are these uplifted blocks that are on the other side of the normal faults. And the other key point that I want to make here in this image is the idea of scaling. In our industry, we generally use the term channel to define preferential flow pathways. But in this context, a channel is actually just a small subset of our overall graben-induced valley. So what we did is, we took this regional understanding, and we took some of the pre-existing data, and now we reevaluated it using sequence stratigraphic correlation techniques. So what you're seeing here is just the overall skeleton of the CPT logs. So to walk you through, we've established the skeleton, so now we're going to fill it out with the flesh. And what we're doing here, you're seeing a series of these vertical profiling tools. So on the left-hand side, on the blacks are representative of our EC logs, whereas the reds are representative of our K values. And what this does is it kind of translates our vertical geologic relationships into a context in which a hydrologist can then translate into their groundwater flow models. So in our fan delta system, for example, we see that our K is generally high. Within our channel bar deposits, we see this overall finding upward succession, and we also see that our highest K appears to be within the course of overall channel bar deposits. Within our Bay Head Delta mouth bars, we kind of see that our K is variable, but our EC data appears to have exhibit these overall overall coarsening upward secessions. And then at our tidal bar, we see that our K increases upwards within a very few low values. So what we did is we took our stratigraphic framework, we filled it in with the flesh, what we defined it as our facies, and now what is revealed is this regional Horst and Graben system. So just to focus in on AA prime, which runs from north to south through our section, with A prime being towards the south, is that we can see that this Horst and Graben system is actually not created equal. So to the south, there is a shallower, more coarse-grained graben, whereas to the north, there's a deeper, more mud-filled graben. And in between, you have these sandy Horst deposits that are separated by these normal faults, these impermeable tectonic barriers. So when we evaluate this Horst and Graben system, and now we're looking at a perpendicular cross-section that runs through CC prime, so the southern shallow Graben system. Now we're seeing that we have, one, you're seeing the heterogeneity that we're able to find using that CPT data, but we're also able to see that we're dealing with a series of stacked high transmissive channel bar deposits that are overtopped by a relatively continuous low K zone. And when we evaluate our well screens, which are defined by these blue lines relative to the geology, and we overlay that with how the plume is moving through it based off of contamination values, we can see that the plume itself is actually dipping towards the Potomac. And more critically, when we analyze the TCE data relative to some of the other wells along this transect, we can see that this well right here exhibits an overall lower TCE value compared to the others. And when we compare the well screen relative to the others, we can see that it's actually screened above and not capturing majority of the mass. More interestingly is that when we analyze this well in plan view, we see that this is also the same well that is causing this migration of this plume towards the north. So what this reveals is that the plume itself actually is moving towards the Potomac, but because of poor well placement, it's not capturing the majority of that mass, and it's significantly impacting our remedial strategy at this site, as well as our mass discharge estimates. So with that, we're going to quickly move through a 3D model that shows how these things can be stitched together, and it shows a really cool video that that integrates geology, hydrology, and chemistry to show these new plumes. And when we look at this, we can see that now we've redefined the plume shape in that you have two different sources, one that's constrained within the shallow graben, and then one that's actually constrained within the Horst itself. But in both cases, neither plume is moving towards the north, but rather they're moving towards the west into the Potomac. So therefore, in a nutshell, we can see that there's no additional need to remediate up towards the north, and rather we can focus our investigative activities down in the southern end of JVAB. So moving back to the slide deck. Thank you. So again, just some implications here that we're dealing with two plumes. They have distinct geologic constraints, and the interpreted orientation of the plumes has significantly differed, which can result in a significant remedial strategy. So just thinking about this again in terms of implications for our project management, is that it's important to point out that CSMs are living, breathing things, and it's important to update them regularly. And this is regardless of site maturity or size. And I think that, you know, we constantly are told that, you know, we already have a conceptual site model, and we already know what the subsurface looks like. So there's no need to reinterpret it. But I think that this case study kind of demonstrates the need that even mature sites that have a lot of pre-existing data can sometimes need can sometimes use a completely new new approach to reevaluate that existing data. When it comes to reducing costs, we prove that the plume is not moving towards the north, so there's no need to go out and sample or collect additional data because of those hydrostratigraphic constraints. These naturally occurring geologic constraints are restricting groundwater flow. So we can target our remedy, we can target our well network. When it comes to refining our mass flux estimates, we are going to define the integral channel bar deposits, their width and thickness and their stacking patterns, and where they occur most, and to show that the plume was actually not moving as originally expected. When it comes to reevaluating the existing well network, we showed you in that cross-section CC prime that a misplaced well can result in a complete change in the way that the plume is interpreted. So being able to reevaluate that existing well network relative to the stratigraphy can be a vital tool for reevaluating the vertical and lateral extent of your contamination. And then finally, when it comes to building stakeholder trust, in this example, this 3D output here did a great job of adding this geologically defensible output that we were able to present to our regulator. And as a result of that regulator buy-in, we're now having an ongoing active collaboration where we're updating the regulator's existing hydrologic model for the area. And we're now integrating the geology with the hydro to create this fully integrated conceptual site model. So with that, and finally, the last point here being the potential implications for emerging contaminants. I think everybody's heard of PFAS and some of the potential relevance here. Because of this model, because we now have the framework in place for a geologic constraint and groundwater flow, we're able to streamline future remedial efforts for these other emerging contaminants or future releases. So with that, I'll have Junaid wrap up.
Yeah, sure. Hi. So time for some final words. The major takeaways. I know, it has been a data overload for you guys. In 2 hours, we tried to give you a lot. But the least you can take out of it is to understand the importance of geology, not just hydrogeology, understanding the subsurface geology for every site you work on, and to be aware of the pitfalls of lithostratigraphy, that sand matching with sand, clay with clay, don't work out always well. Okay, so, and also understand that sequence stratigraphy is a model-based approach, and it has got a predictability. That predictability has to be tested. It's not always true, but it gives you a good indication of what to expect and what to expect so that you can come up with better strategies. So also, garbage in, garbage out. That's still true. If you have very bad data, your results will be very bad too. Sequence stratigraphy can create no magic. But quite often, good data has not been used to its full utility because of lack of understanding of sequence stratigraphic principles. There is where you can have an impact by looking at the pre-existing data and doing a better job there. Also, I would encourage all of us to use the Wentworth scale of logging for cores, because borehole data collection is important. And quite often, I think you'll be frustrated by seeing it's just a pile of sand with some stringers of clay here and there. So we can do a much better job in collecting good data. We can also have more of the geophysical logs, and this is a very good trend that these days we are seeing more and more of geophysical logs, CPT, HPT, NIP data coming in and supplementing our borehole description. So it is actually a time for a paradigm shift within our environmental industry. It has happened long time back in the petroleum industry, as we saw back in the 70s, they started and they peaked in the 90s, and we're still lagging behind. But it's 2020, and let's have a 2020 vision and try to do things differently from now on. Now, once again, we know, like, we have tried to give you a lot of concepts within a very short time. So those of you who are interested, we are also teaching this course as a full-day course in Battelle Conference in Portland. So keep an eye on that. It's already out there for registration. And also, like, apart from that, if you're personally interested to know more about sequence stratigraphy, you can always write to us. We're also on LinkedIn, so let's create a community of practitioners of sequence stratigraphy within the environmental industry. So with those words, we conclude our session of training today. Brian, you want
all
to
right.
say something?
Okay. No, I think it's time for questions.
Okay, good.
Okay. All right, thank you. Well, start to take some of those questions in the queue. If anyone else has additional questions, now is a great time to go ahead and send them on in. I'll start here with a question about incised valleys. They want to know if you could discuss how an incised valley would affect hydraulic flow.
Yeah, I think the greatest implication here is that because of incised valley has the ability to erode into previously deposited sediments. So just because you might have a laterally continuous sand body that would otherwise be separated by a laterally continuous clay unit, because of the creation of an incised valley and its subsequent sandy formation, you have a potential vertical connectivity between your two sand bodies. So you can then have a pathway from your upper sand into your lower sand.
Okay. We had another participant ask if these sort of basic principles could be applied to areas that have had volcanic or seismic activity.
Yes, so, well, okay, so this is a tough question, actually. So sequence stratigraphy, as you saw, has really originated from shallow marine environment. But as you also remember, like, the relationship between accommodation and supply is the key. So even if you are in a seismically deformed area where there has been uplift or change in the accommodation, so that will impact how your deposits will behave. So even in a volcanic area or in an area with seismic deformation, you can apply the same principles of accommodation versus supply. But again, you have to know the timing of those and have to have a regional understanding of the deposition to work with it.
Okay. We had someone asking if you could confirm that the unified soils, are you saying that it is not preferred any longer for logging?
So I think it comes down to the method of collection. So the reason we're suggesting Wentworth classification scale is to understand better geologic data. But that's not to say, you know, so the traditional UCS is useful for understanding our K, but when it comes to understanding our stratigraphic relationships, the Wentworth is of more use. And the way I like to think of it is that if you're going to collect your borehole data once, you might as well get the whole suite rather than stopping short. So if you collect using the Wentworth scale, you've got really good geologic information, but you still maintain your potential grain size implications for groundwater flow. Whereas if you stop short and only use the UCS classification, you're potentially missing the really valuable information for your geologic correlation.
Okay, and then just very quickly about the Wentworth classification system, can you highlight very simply the difference between Wentworth and ASTM?
Yeah, so we actually have a whole separate presentation for that. But so simply put, the Wentworth goes into greater detail about individual grain sizes. So rather than just classifying things based off of a sand, you know, based off of like percentages of, say, you know, some or few sands at a different scale, it goes into a higher resolution for the grain sizes as well as the individual grain characteristics.
Yes, so to go into a little more detail, like in the Wentworth scale, we go from like silt, from clay, silt, very fine sand, and within that very fine, we'll say very fine upper and very fine lower, fine upper, fine lower, medium upper, medium lower. So that's how we increase the resolution of our observation in the data set, okay, which is not there in the other system.
And it may seem like a small detail, but again, when put into the context of this presentation, a very small shift in grain size could have very large implications for where you are lying relative to the regional geologic system.
Yeah, because you saw, like, we look for trends, like when we, in my Pushyak example, like we're trying to find which one are the channels, which one are the deltas, and it all depends on how the grain size changes vertically over time. And for that, you need very precise measurements.
Okay. And we are approaching 3 o'clock, but I've had a few people ask if we could stay on just a few more moments. So we're going to go on just a little bit past 3. For those of you who do need to hop off at 3, I have shared some additional links in terms of how you can access the slides and then get to our feedback form. If you fill that out, you'll be able to obtain a certificate for joining us. But let's turn back to those questions and try to get through just a few more. One of the participants, just as a clarification, noted that Wentworth clay does not necessarily equal clay minerals, and then that's a really big difference. So they just wanted to bring that up. Let's go back to one of the questions about the 3D models and cross-sections. A number of people have asked how you generated them. Were you using a particular software? Did you have some challenges in creating some of the models?
Yes, absolutely. So the approach here was to update an existing EVS model. So we used EVS as the basis for creating these cross sections. And so we had one of our in-house EVS experts help us stitch together the cross sections. So we generated the cross sections individually in Adobe Illustrator. We sent it over to our EVS expert. And then through a very extensive series of scaling and resizing, also we were able to match them according to our geologic understanding. But I will say, as you can tell there from the image, that it was not a simple process.
Yeah.
It was something that took lots of trial and error.
Yeah. Finally, we have a workflow for it, but we have to do it, like as Ryan mentions, trial and error.
Okay. We had a question about using some of your presentation at smaller sites. So they basically comment that it looks like from this presentation you did a lot of correlation work for your sequences based off of geophysical data. And in some cases when they're working on smaller sites where they don't have these types of geophysical logs, they want to know if they only have lithographic logs, does that add in additional difficulties? Are there things that they should be aware of?
Yeah, well, so in that case, we prefer to have, as we already discussed, having a better logging of the sediments using Wentworth scale. And even if that's not possible, like you are only given pre-existing data, the boreholes are not too good to describe in detail, but then you can still do a lot of sequence stratigraphy because you go for regional understanding. So quite often around our project area, we look for all these, do it, an extensive research of academic papers, geological history, sea level curve of the area, and then with a little bit of speculation, we use the same data set as we get and still do a good job there.
I think, you know, to add to that, I think that's critical because if we look at our site data without the context of that regional geology, then we don't have an understanding of what grain size trends that we should be expecting. So even if you have pre-existing lithologic data that, say, maybe doesn't leverage the Wentworth scale, we can still define some of these finding upward or coarsening upward trends when placed within the context of our regional geologic system.
Yeah. And sometimes we even look for oil and gas data close by. Like sometimes people in the environmental industry are so focused within their own field, they don't know, like, there is actually good data right there because some oil company has drilled and gotten some geophysical logs, and we extrapolate those into our projects.
Okay. I'm going to close with this last question here just in the interest of time. And we've seen several questions asking about resources. So they want to know if you have recommendations about other resources when we're looking at sequence stratigraphy. A few people have brought up an EPA publication that came out on environmental sequence stratigraphy. So do you have a collection or sort of a go-to or a library shelf that you have a couple of key resources that you point people to?
Yeah, sure. So we really like to hear it from the horse's mouth. And by that, I mean, like, we go back to the original papers in sequence stratigraphy. So once again, those are papers written by Peter Vail, Henry Possementier, Helen Hansen. All if you approach us, we can give you a long list of academic work and petroleum industry work where sequence stratigraphy has been applied. So our approach is learn the concept from where it came from, and then for application to the environmental industry, you have to improvise, you have to look at other people's work, like AECOM does a lot of that kind of work and we present regularly in different forums. So a combination of learning from the original literature and learning from case studies like what we showed today is a good starting point.
And I think, you know, to add one final, you know, to add on to that, is that while these fundamental papers are a really good start, and the fundamentals of sequence stratigraphy are relatively simple to understand, putting those ideas into practice takes a lot of time. So I think it's important to recognize that even if you have a guidance document or you have some of these foundational papers on sequence stratigraphy, is that it takes many, many years to master and be able to see these things in the boring logs with ease. It's something that you cannot just read papers and immediately apply. It's something that has to be learned through lots of trial and error.
All right. I think with that, we'll go ahead and begin our closeout procedures. But before I jump into those final reminders, Kate, did you want to come back on the line and just refresh the audience's memory of some of those upcoming webinars in the series?
Sure thing. So thanks, gentlemen, for that presentation. I think it was really great and informative while these slides are coming up. So I have a number of slides that I just wanted to remind the audience of some future activities that DCHWS is holding. First, there is the February and March webinars. Again, registration is open for those. We have a number of webinars that we will be announcing shortly, so if you will not be attending these future webinars, please stay tuned to our CLUIN and TechDirect emails. They will be announcing additional webinars as they come up. And with that, I would also recommend, if you thought this topic was interesting, as I mentioned in the beginning, we have a Design and Construction Issues at Hazardous Waste Site Symposium, April 1st through 3rd in Philadelphia. The agenda is being finalized right now and will be sent out. I will coordinate with Jean to have that announced on the CLUIN webpage. So if folks are interested in what that agenda has, what types of topics we'll be talking about or are interested in registering, the information will be shared there as well. So Jean, with that, I will turn it back over to you.
All right, thank you very, very much. Let me walk through just a few final reminders before we close out today's broadcast. So first, I'll echo the thanks to the well over 300 people who joined us from all over the world for today's broadcast, along with our presenters who took time to share their technical expertise with us. As Kate noted, a lot of the information we'll be posting on the CLUIN website, but I also encourage you to sign up for our monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month to learn about future webinars in the series and other technical training in the arena of cleaning up hazardous waste sites. I will remind everybody that the presentation resources, including the slides that were discussed, are already available to download from the seminar resources page. You'll find those on the middle right of the screen. Scroll under related URLs to the seminar resources link, click that, and then press the Browse To button to open it up. If you're replaying the recorded version, you can still click on those links to access the materials. Contact information for our presenters is also on that page. I think a few of you asked some very specific questions, so you can certainly reach out to the instructors if you want more specific information about some of the courses in the future that they referenced, or we're looking for a list of some of the materials that they highlighted in their talk. And then I will ask each of you to fill out an online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's session. If you're replaying the recorded version, you can still click the link to the seminar feedback form on the middle right of your screen. It'll open up. And if you fill that form out at the very bottom, as long as you fill in your email address and you check the box at the bottom to certify you are here for the whole thing or replayed the whole thing, you'll then have access to a participation certificate once you send the form in. So you'll be able to either print that certificate out or save it for your own records. If you joined as a group under somebody else's registration, just make sure that that person in the room who registered gets you the link to the feedback form, and then anybody who sat in on the room can follow that link and fill out the feedback form, even if they didn't register individually. So each of you can get your own certificate, again, even if you didn't register individually for this session. Please know I do read each and every one of the submissions that comes in through the feedback form, so we really do count on your input to help to continue these online deliveries. With that, today's session was recorded with the others in the series, and you'll get an email from me in approximately